The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to CBF Legal. It's lovely that you should be here on a little bit of an overcast morning. We welcome, of course, Ian Powell, our regular speaker here, and he is going to be speaking today and over the next two Thursday mornings on this theme of Jesus sui generis, one of a kind, perhaps. Inside your program, there is a passage printed from the Bible on the left and a few comments on the right. And as usual, our drill here at CBF Legal, if you've got any comments or questions, scribble them out on your piece of paper and we'll collect them, and Ian will do his best to respond, and we'll be done by 20 past the hour. So Ian, we look forward to you kicking off this three-part series.
I wouldn't normally use such a title, but I think it's many of you work in the world of legalities and things like that, you'll be all too familiar with Latin. We toyed with this phrase last year, sui generis, and it has the sense of you are one of a kind. So Donald Bradman is not that. You may be the best of something, but that's a different thing altogether to sui generis, which means that you are the only type in that group. You may know that one of the marks, according to Mark's Gospel, of really not seeing Jesus at all is that you say he is an something. He's a prophet. He's a enlightened person. He's a. I think in the mind of Jesus, until you say he's a ver, you haven't got it. So the crowd are saying he is one of the prophets. He's a prophet. But according to Jesus, the answer that shows any sort of insight is when you say he is the Christ. But not only is Jesus that, as we'll look over the next few weeks, but also this passage is unique. At least unique as far as I'm aware of. You'll know if you look at the passage in a Bible rather than a handout that you've been given to make it easier. It will have a note like it does say in this one here. Most ancient authorities lack these verses. Other authorities have the passage in chapter 7 or sometimes in part of Luke. So it's a slightly dodgy thing to do in a sense. We're actually looking at a passage that all the earliest manuscripts of John don't have. All the earliest commentaries on John make no comment on. One of the ways that we can test and see just how accurately the documents of the New Testament have come down is even if you lose the documents, we've got so much commentary by the early Christian writers that you can work out almost the entire New Testament just from that. This passage is missing. So great scholars like Metzger from Princeton, recently dead, who's perhaps the best of the scholars in the world of the text of the New Testament. It's quite clear this is not where this passage originally lives, but it's also quite clear, as are most scholars of whatever persuasion, that this story is a real story of Jesus. So I thought it might be worthwhile looking at it. It's one of the passages about Jesus that is often quoted, at least a line is quoted, but normally I think it's fair to say in our culture, it's not quoted because we agree with Jesus, but we use a line because it agrees with us. But we'll come to that part. So let's have a look at this firstly, this particularly unpleasant story at the beginning, and then it turns good. John chapter 8, verse 2. Early in the morning, Jesus came again to the temple. All the people came to him and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. Placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law of Moses, we are commanded to stone such a woman. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. So he brings this woman who is as guilty as hell. There's no attempt here. They seem to have jumped right past the court case to see if she's guilty and straight to sentencing. She's been caught in the act of adultery. So presumably they actually found her having sex with a man who was not her husband. Now, you don't even want to think about how they did that. I would think it's likely that they set this up. She may well have been a woman of loose moral character. The Jewish people of Jesus' time were highly religious in many of the centres, and yet also deeply immoral, not an uncommon thing. It's not always the case, but there was quite a lot of sexual immorality going on. A few women worked as prostitutes, often, as you'll know, in that sort of culture, because they were driven to it. They had very little financial option. But the woman is caught in the act of adultery, and she's used as bait. One of the things that real fishermen do that I have problems doing is catching fish and then putting a big hook through them and chucking them in the water as live bait. I hope to grow out of that one day. But my feeling is, if a carnivorous animal wants to eat me, but don't stick a big hook through me and use me to catch something bigger. So prawns, yes. Bits of plastic, yes. Live bait. This woman is live bait. She's been trapped, and she's now put a hook through and thrown in front of Jesus in order to trap him. They do not come to him seeking advice. The people who come to him in verse 3 are the scribes and the Pharisees. So if you've got the picture, Jesus seated, as a Jewish teacher is when they teach. He's in the temple, the palace of God. The Pharisees, the scribes, the priests, they run the show, and they're sort of hillbilly preacher from Queensland has come down and is in the middle of their opera house or whatever it is, and he's teaching. The scribes and the Pharisees, the elite, the scholars and the best, they bring this woman. And they try to trap him by putting him between, well, we presume they're trying to put him between the law of Moses and the law of the Romans. The law of Moses was crystal clear, Deuteronomy 22:22 and other verses, that if a couple are caught committing adultery, both are to be put to death. There's no question about what should happen. Why are they asking him? Well, because the Romans had this thing, as dictators do, that they're the only people allowed to kill people. So in quite a few countries, as in Indonesia and places like that, when the dictator goes, it can become more problematic sometimes for minority groups. Dictators, rulers, imperial powers, think they're the only people allowed to kill. So when I was in Vanuatu last year doing a bit of work, and you know, I know that sounds like a joke, but I sort of was, how was it that cannibalism was removed from Vanuatu? Because it was happening right up to the middle of last century. Because the French and the Pommies basically imprisoned or executed anybody who did it. Imperial powers are the only people allowed to kill. And so by asking them this, they're saying to Jesus, well, are you going to side with the law of Moses? In which case we can dob you into the Romans as a troublemaker. Or are you going to side with the law of the Romans, in which case we can charge you before our own courts of blaspheming and dishonouring God? Or maybe they're trying to trap him between his obvious concern for mercy and forgiveness and renewal, that he is slow to run to judgment, as he says earlier in chapter 3, I didn't come to judge but to save. Are they trying to trap him between that, between his obvious kindness and the concern for true moral standards? Either which way, the woman is being used. Arguably, the law of Moses is being used. Everyone's being used in order to get rid of this troublesome opponent of theirs in Jesus. Well, she's guilty. They're guilty. They're trying to show the guilt of Jesus. How does Jesus move? Now, this is one of the times, I think, where it's true for us that it's very hard for us to see the sheer brilliance of this. If it is sadly true, familiarity breeds contempt. I went recently to a funeral, met a man there who had grown up in Sydney, had moved away from Sydney for a few years, and he was saying with quite a lot of energy and passion, he said, I had never realised what a beautiful harbour this place had, even though I grew up quite close to it. He said, it was only when I went away for a couple of years and then flew back in over the harbour and then came to Darling Harbour that I realised, my goodness, this is beautiful. It is one of the difficulties for humans that familiarity almost always breeds contempt. So people often don't get what an extremely brilliant piece of work this is. This is not the picture that you get in Boston Legal of someone working late at night trying to find the brilliant comeback. This is a guy caught unprepared, with a very clever trap. He loses either which way with Jesus. He's not interested. He leans down and writes with his finger into the dirt. A number of people who understand literature and the development of literature say that this is one of the marks of John's eyewitnessy style, because particularly in ancient literature, no one did realistic fiction. The notion that we have of adding irrelevancies, like, you know, whether or not the detective had milk in his coffee or sugar in his coffee, that's a very modern construct. But it pops up in the Gospels quite often. It's what you do if you were there and saw it. Nothing is made of Jesus writing in the sand. It's interesting historically that he could obviously write. Not all religious teachers that we know could. Jesus could. Nothing is made of it. What did he write? We're not told. Was what he wrote in the sand significant? Who knows? Some scholars think very significant. Some scholars think that what he wrote was something like, "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife," or something. It's just as likely that he just wrote, who knows? But it's what the eyewitnesses record. Jesus is trying to avoid the conversation. How does he set this woman free? Because she is in all sorts of trouble. Because the other problem that shows bad faith is, where's the man? I've not seen too many articles of the troubles cultures have with women committing adultery on their own. Adultery is a team sport. It's very clear in the law of Moses that the man and the woman are to be brought. And the other thing is, by the way, that while there was the death penalty for a number of limited offences in the Old Testament, you needed two eyewitnesses of the event. It was actually very hard. And the Jewish writings of the time, the Mishnah, say this, that any court that had handed out two death penalties within 7 years was not a court but a slaughterhouse. So they actually made it quite hard to gain a conviction. How is Jesus going to set this woman free? Well, as you probably know, verse 7, they continued to ask him. He stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." Let him who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. He is not saying that she should not be stoned. But he's saying, okay, you guys, you want to do this, you want to play condemnation game, well, the first person who hasn't sinned, let them throw the stone. It's brilliant, isn't it? He saves the woman, he begins to save these horrible self-righteous men, and he also saves himself. It's quite an act of verbal and intellectual brilliance. But what Jesus is doing here is the classic thing that Jesus does is, you'll know the description of Jesus, he disturbs the comfortable and comforts the disturbed. That's what Christianity always does. So if you're comfortable and arrogant and deluded about yourself, you'll find Jesus very uncomfortable. That's why you'll probably avoid reading him. He comforts the disturbed, but he disturbs the comfortable. So he firstly disturbs his guy. So, okay, you want to play chucking a stone. The person who hasn't sinned, they can begin. Verse 8. Once more Jesus bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they, presumably the scribes and the Pharisees, the scribes and the sort of the elite, when they heard it, they went away one by one. They came as a herd, dragging this woman, probably semi-clothed, to throw her on the ground in front of her. They leave one by one, the older leading first. Again, we're not told why it is that John observes that it's the older, but presumably it's got something to do with self-knowledge. An awareness you get as you get older that it's not just right to have high standards, but you become aware of your own repeated incapacity to live as you'd like to. The old go first, followed by the younger. Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" So in the end, the comfortable self-righteous are disturbed and they leave. And it's the woman and Jesus alone. He calls her woman. I don't want you to make of that word. That's the same word he uses to call his mother in John chapter 2. People think it sounds harsh in both contexts. It is one of the words that's hard to get a clear, easy translation into English. It's a word of respectful friendliness, is what it is. I've said when we looked at John 2 some years ago, it's the sort of word when I was at Shore I might call the headmaster's wife. right, who was a very friendly lady, a great lady, but she, but, you know, it's a sort of, it's that sort of word. So Jesus calls his mother that, which you never call your mother because it should be more intimate. Here he calls this woman, who all he knows about her is that she's an adulterer, really. He calls her woman, a respectful term. She calls him Lord. He says to her, where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you? They have left. He has protected her. He has fended them off. She is now alone in his company. Well, the disciples and the other people who came for teaching are presumably there. But the mob of the righteous have gone. Then he says these words to her. This is also equally brilliantly balanced. She says, no one, Lord. Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. Now that is where some movies, some modern movies about Jesus, have finished this statement. This is where people wanted to finish. That is where some people wanted to finish. That Jesus should just say, hey, it's okay, why me? I mean, why would I worry about adultery? I mean, particularly a Hollywood Jesus. How could he possibly worry about adultery? But he again, he's got both. Neither do I condemn you. Go and from now on, sin no more. It's possible to overly sympathize with this woman. She's not pictured as an innocent victim. She is a victim, but she's a guilty victim. It's very clear in the teaching of Jesus that adultery is sin. It's evil. It will, unrepented, it will send you to hell. If you have sex with someone you're not married to, Jesus is as hard on that as anywhere else in the Old Testament. Well, we'll come to the question of following in a second. But he's very clear. She is not to sin ever again. She's to be done with that. Go and sin no more. But also he says, I don't condemn you. So he's saying to her, in this sort of classic New Testament thing, you are guilty, but I won't condemn you. Right? You're not innocent. You're not excused. The Bible never excuses any sin. You'll hear when people have done something wrong, I'm sure you've heard yourself do it, children do it, adults do it. They'll have been caught doing something wrong and they'll come out with excuses. Don't ever do that if you're dealing with God. God never excuses. He only ever forgives. It's quite a different thing that he does. It's this blend of, I'm not going to condemn you. You are guilty, but there is no sentence. Now this is, of course, a problem, isn't it? How do you both act mercifully and justly? How do you maintain the right without crushing the person who's done the wrong? This is one of the great tensions. We often feel the tension as we deal with people and friends, family members, etc. It doesn't look as if Jesus feels the tension. It's one of the interesting things about Jesus that I've been asking people of late in a particular social medium, what is it about Jesus they find most impressive? And a number of people have spoken of his blend of purity and grace, of the highest standards for himself and for others, and yet without being judgmental and harsh as the Pharisees became. So he says to her, gives her this blend of it. Don't sin again. So stop doing that. No more adultery for you. But he won't condemn her. He's basically saying to her sister, little sister, you can go free, because later on I'm going to do my great work and I'm going to be stoned in your place. I will die in your place. He's never ever saying that sin doesn't matter. That's a peculiar abuse of Christianity, to say God's so kind it doesn't matter. The Bible's quite clear. God will by no means clear the guilty. Sin will be punished, but Jesus knows he will bear it, so she goes free. So she's alone with Jesus and safe with Jesus, and off she goes to a new life, set free as a bird. Well, this brings us to the last point for the day, and that is that last statement by Jesus. Again, it's that utterly unique statement. Look at what Jesus says here in verse 12. Again, Jesus spoke to them, speaks to us, speaks to Sydney, saying, I am the... it's hard not to overemphasize each word. I am the. The I am, as quite a few of you all know, is the divine name. Moses asks, who will I say sent me? He says, I am. I am who I am. He's self-defining. Jesus picks up this ego eimi. I am the light of the world. So he pictures the world as being in darkness. As you can see in what he says next, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. It is the clear assumption of Jesus, and you may want to disagree with him, that without him, you are living in the darkness. You are ignorant. You are deluded about yourself. You are threatened by death. You are in the darkness of guilt. You're in the darkness of slavery to yourself. You are alone, without God, without hope. Of course, as the Bible says, many of us, being fools, we declare ourselves to be wise. We call the bitter things sweet. Jesus assumes that without him the world is in darkness. But he says, I come as light in a dark world. I am the light. I don't think anyone would much mind if Jesus said, I am a light. In fact, I would think almost everyone is happy to say Jesus is a light. Whether it's a light who brings moderately reasonable ethical teaching or some spiritual path or whatever. But Jesus could have said that quite easily, but there's a very clear extra word added, so it's not a, it's the. You know that in Greek the way it works is, if you don't put the in, an a is assumed. So there's no word for a in Greek. So a thing is an a unless you put the in. Is that making sense? It's just a different way they do it. So it's very clear he's saying, I am the light of the world. That he will bring, instead of death, life. He will bring, instead of ignorance about all the ultimate questions, truth. He will bring, instead of guilt, mercy and compassion and free forgiveness. Instead of alienation, he will bring his presence. Instead of slavery, as he says in John 8, he will set us free. He comes as the Son. And he comes in that capacity alone. This is what he says. And it is most clearly seen in this question of grace. So down the bottom of your page, I have a quote from the Hadiths. This is quite a famous story. If you talk with someone about Islam, and they say that this is not a problem, Muslims don't believe it because it's not in the Quran. A person who says that to you is either semi-ignorant or deliberately misleading you. Because the Christianity and Islam are not the same in this regard. Christianity would say, most forms, if it's not in the Bible, it's not essential. That is simply not the case with Islam. So, for example, of the great pillars of Islam, the five prayers of the day, where do you find those? Not in the Quran. Where are they? In the Hadiths, the sayings of the Prophet. An enormous amount of what is essential to Islam is not in the Quran. So that it's the Quran and the Hadiths. Here's a story of a woman, a little bit like what happened with Jesus. Let me read it to you. This is in Muslim. The two great standard works of Hadiths gathered by the early Muslims are Al-Bukhari and Muslim. Let me read you what this says. I've left out the chain of who heard it from who heard it from who heard it from who heard it, but all the Hadiths say, because I figured for most of us here it's fairly meaningless. So it's just the narrator. The narrator said this. There came to the Holy Prophet a woman from Garmid and said to Allah's messenger, I have committed adultery, so purify me. He turned her away. On the following day she said, to Allah's messenger, why do you turn me away? Perhaps you turn me away as you turned away Mazi, the guy who was executed in the story before this one. By Allah, I have become pregnant. He said, well, if you insist upon it, then go away until you give birth to the child. When she was delivered, she came back with the child wrapped in a rag and said, here is the child whom I have given birth to. The Prophet said, go away and suckle him until you have weaned him. When she had weaned him, she came to him with the child who was holding a piece of bread in his hand. She said, Allah's Prophet, here is he as I weaned him and he eats food. He, that's Muhammad, entrusted the child to one of the Muslims, then pronounced sentence. She was put in a ditch up to her chest and he commanded the people and they stoned her. From Ibn Ishaq, the earliest biography of Muhammad, in his last speech before he went for his last pilgrimage to Mecca, where soon after that he died, he reminds them that the adulterer must be stoned. So I'm just putting out there, not to say one is right or one is wrong, but it's quite a difference. Here is Jesus who finds a woman dragged before him, and he protects her from those who are self-righteous and protects her from her own sin by freeing her from it by mercy and release. the other interesting story, just so we can see the uniqueness of the way Jesus approaches this, is the Buddha story that you'll know from the it's the equivalent of the prodigal son. You know, the prodigal son of Jesus, which is quite like this, where when he turns, he is immediately forgiven, although he's wasted the family's fortune and discredited the name. In the similar story in the Buddhist writings, the young man comes home, and the father, what does he do in Buddhism? He sends him out to pay off his karma. He sends him out to work in the fields. Because you must pay off karma. There is no forgiveness in karma. You must pay off karma. And so I'm just mentioning that to you, not to in any way discredit, but just to contrast the teaching of Jesus, who in himself finds a way to be both the upholder of that which is true and right, sin no more, and yet the releaser of those who are caught. Various people like various halves. Let me finish with this story from when I was at St. Barnabas Broadway. We had a lovely couple. They were down to get married, which they did eventually get married, and then she got pregnant before the marriage. So we talked about it, and they got up in church and said that, confessed to the community what they'd done, and they owned it, what they'd done, that they had sinned, they weren't married, they'd had sex intercourse together, and because they kind of weren't, they didn't take adequate precautions, she was pregnant. It was interesting what happened, because I announced it. When they'd spoken, I talked about it, and I mentioned the fact, of course, what they've done is not right before God. It's terrific that they've kept the kids, and it's terrific that they've come clean. They could have just left the church and hidden it, but they've just come out to their Christian community, and they are as forgiven as I am for my gossip, you know, from the day before. They've owned it as sin, and God has dealt with it. What interested me was two things. And I hadn't scripted this, but it was perfect. The congregation burst into applause. And it was led by the fellow who was headmaster at Shaw School there, who's still there, Tim Wright. Because I remember watching, because I just made the comment, I don't know exactly what happens next. And he's probably the oldest bloke in the congregation, apart from me. I'm not sure who's older. Anyhow, he's the oldest bloke sitting in the congregation. And he started the applause in the congregation. The other thing is that a number of really young, keen Christians came to me afterwards, and they were not happy. They were not happy that forgiveness seemed to be offered so quickly, that they were worried this would make a bad standard. And their concern is understandable. But I thought the older man was, he got it, that we all sin. And Jesus comes as light. He will discomfort you until you call your sin sin. And once it is seen, he will comfort. So it's the light that is unpleasant when you're in denial, but wonderfully comforting. And I don't know about you, I've not recently been caught in adultery and dragged before some church court, but just in case you're worried, that's never actually happened to me. I don't know if we even do that. But there are enough times when I think, gosh, I've done it again, I'm a grub, really. And to realise that when I stand alone before Jesus, he says, Ian, I don't condemn you, but go and sin no more. Well, we'll leave it there with some time. Hopefully plenty of time for some intelligent questions and some moderate answers.
Well, thank you, Ian. Certainly lots of food for thought there. Do take up the opportunity to write down any comments or questions on those slips of paper. Whilst you're doing that, perhaps, if you're not doing that, just turn over the back of your outline. You can see that we're meeting two more weeks. Then we're going to have a small break and recommence on the 18th of July. So just a heads up, please note that in your diaries. And also there, please note, Life, the Universe and Nothing. This is going to be a great event at the Sydney Town Hall on Tuesday the 13th of August. A discussion between Dr. William Lane Craig and Professor Lawrence Krauss, both hailing from the States. And they're out here in August. Actually, Krauss is often out here. He's probably 3 months of the year out here, but William Lane Craig is visiting for a couple of weeks. And they'll be speaking in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne over the course of 8 days. But the Sydney event, Tuesday, August 13. Tickets are on sale. The early bird rate is mentioned there. You can get a discount if you buy 5 or more tickets. Then it's only $25. And go to lifeuniversenothing.org, or those into Facebook, you can also find it on a similar URL. And make sure you register. In the first week, some 450-500 tickets have been purchased. But we're looking to have 4,000 people there across the three venues. So please do come along and bring some friends. Now, I'll just collect any comments or questions you might have, and Ian will be back.
Well, Peter, does that, do you want to yell any questions out from the floor? Oh, I like this one. On a bit of ancient papyrus. The tissue of lies. Tissue of questions. Okay. Alright. The law of Moses did not stipulate that the stoners be without sin, so it looks like Jesus is directly challenging that law. Thank you. He might be. I don't think the law of Moses is quite clear about who's supposed to stone, except the eyewitnesses must stone. So you can't bear witness against someone and then let someone else execute. You have to be amongst those who do. I think what Jesus is doing is he's loving both the woman and those who come to stone. They didn't have to take his advice at all. He's not in any way got any jurisdiction. So I mentioned they should have gone to the Sanhedrin. That they go to this travelling preacher is an indication that they're not interested. All they're doing is trying to trap Jesus. And they try that a few times. That other brilliant one, when they bring the coin to Jesus. You know, should we pay taxes? Right? If he says yes, it seems as if he's, you know, banking it with the Romans. If he says no, they've got a great charge. I mean, the Romans were much more serious about collecting tax than our government is. Again, Jesus gets out of that, you know, in a second. You know, whose head's on the coin? Give to Caesar what is. So I don't think he's directly challenging the law. I think, though, he is trying to rescue the self-righteous blind men from themselves. Why and how was Jesus allowed to sit in the temple and teach? Was Jesus licensed? Or was he just allowed to? But that's a good question. It's quite clear that Jesus keeps going to the temple. If you read chapter 7 in John's eyewitness account, there's a lot of trouble in the temple there. The authorities aren't happy with what he's saying. They send some temple soldiers to arrest him. But they come back impressed by what he says. They come back and they say, didn't you arrest him? And they said, well, no man ever spoke like this man. And then the religious authorities mock them for being fools. It does look as if, from just reading, and I can perhaps try and do some background work, on that you were able to, in the size of the temple, which remember was huge. It was one of the architectural marvels of that time. It was also a great money-raising centre. It had a fortune from Jews who would contribute to it from all around the empire. But it just seemed that various people could get up and teach in various parts. It wasn't like a little church. It was a number of football field size is the size you're dealing with. So it looks as if various places people would get up and talk together or preach. They didn't like him that. How can this be applied in the law in New South Wales? Well, as an expert on the law in New South Wales, I haven't got the faintest clue. I wouldn't think it should be, really, should it? Except I take it we try to engage in justice with mercy. Is that, I don't know if that's a legal term, but I would think that's what we try to do. We'd like our judges and magistrates to be wise and not always just... I think, isn't that why certain legal people don't like, fixed sentences? If you're found guilty, you've got to give the whole penalty to leave some discretion with those who've heard the case. I'm not sure if it should be. But you sure as hell want it to be applied to you and God. Right? Whatever side of that equation, whether or not you're the woman who feels thrown by your guilty conscience at the feet of Jesus, or whether or not you're the one who likes to bring other people's sins to the attention of God and yourself. I think that's who it's for. What might Jesus have said if it had not been an adulterous woman brought before him, but a child rapist or murderer? I don't know. I'm not very good at guessing what he would do. At that point, I prefer to be an empiricist and see what he did do. Don't know. I imagine it would have been different. Yeah, I can't help you that. You mentioned the requirement for the witnesses, but did they convict if the accused confessed? Yes. Could they be verbal? As I recall the law of Moses, the basic thing is two witnesses, two eyewitnesses. So he couldn't get a Lindy Chamberlain nonsense that we had. When that happened, where it was all done on scientific forensic stuff that was just a little bit mistaken. You had to be seen. And that, I think, it's worth recalling, because the Old Testament law does sound very harsh to us in our culture, which may be a statement about us, or it might be a statement about the law. Both could be the case. But it was, they were very careful to make sure that you couldn't have vexatious, I heard something happened. You actually had to see the persons in bed together, or perhaps even more than that. I don't know how much action you had to see. But it was quite hard to get a conviction of adultery or murder. But there's nothing that I can recall. Can anyone else recall anything about confessions in the Old Testament? I don't think it was used. I think you had to have eyewitnesses. And I think that's why in the Ten Commandments you have that statement, you shall not bear false witness. I don't think it's just about me not lying to my mother. But I think it's more seriously about that, because it was on verbal testimony that people could live or die. The last, most important one on the ancient papyrus. What would have happened if the woman was unable to sin no more? Well, what would have happened if the woman was unable to sin no more? She was unable to sin no more. I don't think there's any doubt the woman sinned again, whether or not she committed adultery again. We had this discussion at church on Sunday, just a few of us over coffee. I think we tend to obsess sometimes, I should say, I think Western Christian people tend to obsess about sins of attitude. So dopey preachers like myself, in order to make good people feel a bit guilty so they'll know that they need Jesus, have said silly things like, if you've thought a lustful thought, that's the same as adultery. Rubbish. Right? If you've hated your brother, it's the same as killing him. Rubbish. I would much rather you hate me than kill me. I'd much rather you hate my wife than kill her. Right? It's just not the same. What Jesus is saying is, he's attacking the very self-righteous, right, who is what he's having a go at. There's a very clear difference between sins of thought and sins of action, in terms of the way in which they impact people. The Bible's quite well aware of that, which is why some sins in the Old Testament have capital offences attached to them, because of what they do to people and societies. So kidnapping, for example, that's a capital offence, which has got something to play with the constant chatter now about how the Bible doesn't condemn slavery. Well, it condemns kidnapping. So any sort of slavery based on taking people against their will is going to have all sorts of problems. Of course she will sin like you and I do, but she is called to take seriously the call not to do it again, and frankly adultery is not a hard sin not to do. It's a question of saying, I ain't going down that path, so I'm going to be careful. Don't flirt with someone, you know, and have drinks with someone who you're feeling attracted to, who you're not married to. Right? As Martin Luther says, if you've got a head made of butter, don't sit near the fire. Right? So if you find yourself attracted to someone, I would think, you know, if you're a married person, or you're finding yourself attracted to someone, if you're not married, who you shouldn't be, you want to talk with a friend about that immediately, whether you're Christian or not. Because the road down that road is just pain and despair, both to you and to many others. We will sin, but I can tell you with an honest heart today, my intention is to not sin at all today. And I'll get to the end, a bit like I have been at sport, when I used to play sport, that you intend to tackle everything that moves or come near, you miss a couple. Well, you keep working on it. I've been impressed, a friend of mine whose father was one of Sydney's best organists, he was having lessons into his 80s and trying to improve his technique. I think that's what we're doing. The last one, we've got time for one more, Peter, or not? Would her experience have meant that unlike us, she would not sin again? So would her experience of Jesus? No. It would have been unforgettable. I don't think she'd have headed down that road again. She may well have had issues forgiving the people who publicly humiliated her and used her as bait to get someone else. But Jesus is quite unique in the way that he deals with sin, in a way that sometimes we don't get because it's so influenced our culture. Mercy, and yet holding the highest standards, brought together, of course, at his death, where he brings all this together. Thank you for your time.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.